Great, Liz. Thank you very much. And just a warm welcome to everybody that's here today. Thanks for coming out. As Liz said, I'll be speaking in more detail about the second Bird Atlas. I know that Liz has mentioned that there were some aspects that he looked over in his first presentation, but this morning I'm just going to hopefully provide you with a bit more detail, unpack the Atlas, and inspire you, hopefully, to get involved with this wonderful citizen science project. Okay, but I can't really speak about the second Atlas without speaking about the first Atlas. Is there anybody here who was involved with the first Bird Atlas? Okay, two, three people. All right, great. It's always good to have people who have been involved with things like this. And for those who have, I'm sure you've got these two huge volumes, or perhaps other people as well, lying on your bookshelf. And this is the result of 5 years of field work that took place between 87 and 91. But the Atlas itself was only really published in 1997. So it took a long while to get from the data stage through to the final publication phase. But I think we just need to have a look at setup one, as I'm going to call it, in a bit more detail. And the project involved thousands of volunteers, which we now call citizen scientists. And these people collected literally millions of bird records that covered the whole of Southern Africa. And basically, it was quite simple. These citizen scientists, birders generally, went out and within these grid cells, these small grid cells over here, the ones that are colored in red, they went out and made lists of birds that they saw in these grid cells. Basically submitted those to the ADU, and we curated the information and computerized it and analyzed it. And this was the final result that came out of that. And for the first time, we have maps of South African birds that show the true distribution of these species. Because here were people out in the field actually seeing the birds where they were. Before that, there was a lot of guesswork involved. There were, I think a lot of the people relied on museum specimens to pinpoint locations on maps. But for the first time, here we have a nice idea as to where the birds actually occur. And this ended up being a really huge project. In fact, it was one of the largest that had ever been undertaken on the continent. And one of the quotes out of the book said that it was a research tool of immense value, not only to conservationists, but to researchers and scientists as well. There were lots and lots of papers that came out of the first Atlas. But what was really nice about the first Atlas is that we had this interesting statistic over here, the reporting rate. Okay, and this is just really the percentage of bird lists for a grid cell with the species represented on that list, ticked on that list. So the more times a bird was ticked on a list in relation to the number of lists, the higher that rate would be. And so the maps over here that were eventually produced showed the reporting rates for each of the grid cells in which the species was found. So the darker squares would represent areas where the bird was assumed to be more abundant. Okay, it's a relative abundance index. We're not looking at the number of individuals, but the reporting rate gives us some idea as to how abundant that species was in that grid cell over that five-year period. And as you can see, so if we look at the black sunbird, now called the amethyst sunbird, you can basically see, if you sort of put your eyes out of focus, and you can get a general idea as to the smudges on the map where the bird is a lot more abundant, a lot more common compared to areas, these lighter shaded grid cells and really understand the distribution of the species at that particular time. So that was step one, and that took place in the late 80s and the early 1990s, and that was some time ago, wasn't it? And we all know that things are changing. The buzzword nowadays, climate change, isn't it? You have to just open a newspaper or look on a website, and we hear about what's happening to the Earth's climate, and there's all sorts of predictions are taking place for certain regions, but basically the globe is warming up, okay? And that's going to have all sorts of implications for biodiversity and naturally birds. More and more people are inhabiting the planet, and so there's large amounts of pressure being placed on the planet's resources. Development, another nasty word that we often don't like to hear, do we? we just got to think about all the housing developments going up and wind farms that are being proposed, solar farms, and these are going to really take up space in the landscape. How are they going to impact on our biodiversity? So linked to development, we've obviously got landscape changes as well. We just have to look around us and see how this can range from being on a small scale in your own suburb to a much larger scale. And we just have to look at how farming, how agriculture has transformed a lot of the natural habitats in the country. So if you look at all of these things together, how have they changed and how are they going to affect our birds? And so along comes step two, okay. The second Bird Atlas project. And this is going to allow us a really nice opportunity to find out how things have changed. How have our birds been impacted over the last 20 odd years? Have they been impacted? Is it affecting certain species? Through the actual process of collecting the data for this project, we'll be able to find out. Compared to other groups of species, and I'm thinking about reptiles, you know, for example, and amphibians, which we don't see every day and which are hidden most of the time, birds have really got a wonderful, we've got a wonderful opportunity to monitor changes in bird populations. Okay, birds are quite noticeable organisms. I mean, you only have to step out your back door and find a whole host of species in your back garden, for example. And we can see them every day. And so that provides us with real nice opportunities to monitor how species are going to change. So we can monitor the birds at a certain point in time, i.e. step one, and now, 20 years later, we can do it again. Okay. And we know that birding is a growing hobby. More and more people are becoming involved. And as a result of this hobby, this passion to go out and just list birds because I want to see a new bird and make a life list, we can translate that into really good bird data. So we can pulse monitor bird populations. And so ultimately, we want to answer the question that if there are changes in species distribution and abundance, what are these changes and why have they changed? And so through funding from SANBI, we managed to launch the second Bird Atlas project on the 1st of July 2007. So we've been hobbling along for the past 4.5 years, we've really made some excellent progress during that time, which I will speak about in a short while. But what is SAVEP2 all about? What is the real essence of the second Bird Atlas project? Well, we need to make sure that it's a scientific project, okay? Because we need to get the information out in a certain way, and we need to present it in a certain way. It must be being able to repeat what we're doing so that we can track through time and space the impacts of environmental change on our birds. Okay, so we need to make sure that we do things in the right way and that we do things in the same way. Okay, so we can compare information and compare the data that's been collected. And that was sort of the main focus, the main thrust, I call it the main aim of the Bird Atlas. But a subsidiary aim, although not least important at all, is to try and increase the participation of the public in a project like this so that we can enhance the collection of biodiversity information. And we knew from step one that this could be done. We had millions of observers out in the field collecting information for the first atlas, and here was an opportunity to do it again. In a bit more of a rigorous way, because we needed to move forward, we needed to make sure that we collect better information. With all the climate change issues around, we needed to ensure that the information that we do collect was far superior than what was collected during SAPAP 1. I mean, SAPAP 1 was a huge success. We managed to collect lots and lots of checklists, and the information that came out of it was extremely significant. But now we have a chance to improve the technology, more people becoming interested in birds and joining bird clubs to enhance that. So there was this real push for SAPAP 2 to get more people on board and mobilize citizen scientists. Okay, and that was basically the two major aims of SAPAP 2. So here we have a picture of myself and a few other people out on the Cape Flats, the place called Edith Stevens Wetland Park. I don't know if anybody's been out there. Basically it's a city of Cape Town Reserve, and they've been linked to Kirstenbosch and Sandby, and they've got some money from WWF to turn this into a small little nature area. And it's one of the places that I've spent a lot of time at, and it's one of the places that we do our accessing at. And basically, each of these individuals here, including myself, we're citizen scientists. Okay, we are people that are part of the public, but we have a hobby, and we're going to turn that hobby into something that is purposeful. Often there's people that go around making lists of birds, and they write it in their notebook, and they put it in a drawer, or they put it somewhere without it actually being used. And now we can go out there, and we can do our birding with a purpose, knowing that the information we collect can be submitted to the ADU, and it's going to get thrown into this huge machine called a computer, and we're going to be able to do all sorts of wonderful statistical analyses with these things. So at the end of the day, you're making a contribution towards a scientific project. And I think for a lot of people in the past, they didn't realize that. They knew they were making a contribution, but this whole citizen scientist terminology thing was only coming to the fore in the last 10 years or so. So you are playing a very important role, because there aren't enough scientists out there to go and do all the work. So ultimately, if you have a passion for birding, if you are a birder, then you can really make your birding count towards an important biodiversity project. I don't know if Les managed to, I think he did touch on this in his talk on Monday, but I just want to put SAPAP 2 into the framework of the citizen science world. So basically, at the core of the project is the steering committee, and they're the big gurus who make all the big decisions about how the project moves forward and etc. And around this revolves the work. So basically the field work is where all the data is collected, and that's done by UFOC. And then you submit the data to the ADU, and this is where it's all managed and curated so that we can use it. So the next step in the phase is the planning phase, because from here the data gets analyzed and certain outputs are produced, and we can use that for policy and advocacy ultimately. But is this enough? Is this where it all ends? And I think for me at least, and the project team, there's really important outputs that need to be generated from all of this. And that must be translated into conservation action on the ground. We don't want to spend all our time out in the field getting all this information, and ultimately it's not going to impact on the conservation initiatives that are currently running in the country. And if we don't do that, then we're not going to have this early warning system that Les spoke about on Monday. Okay, because through all of this, we will be able to say, hang on, these species don't look as though they're doing too well at the moment. Or perhaps, gee, these species are actually on the increase. What's going on? And there may be threatened species that aren't doing too well. And we need to have some sort of system in place to warn us about these species and their populations. So, and this circle keeps on turning all the time. Because as better data is collected, so we can do better policy and advocacy at the end, and the better the conservation action at the end of the day. Okay, so that's basically what the second bird atlas is about in a nutshell. And I'd like to take you to the next level now, and that is to find out, what have we achieved? Like I said in the beginning, we've been running for the past 4.5 years or so, and so there's been a lot of the data that has been submitted, and we need to find out, is the project actually answering the questions that we asked at the outset? Because that's valuable information that we're collecting. Is it can be used for what the intended purposes was? So this is the hub of everything, really, and that is these citizen scientists out in the field doing what they love and realizing that their contributions are going to make a meaningful contribution to biodiversity conservation. They know before they leave, before they've planned to go out and collect the data, that it's going to be used, that there's going to be useful outcomes from the time that they've spent in the field. And believe me, there are some people here who have spent hundreds of hours and spent thousands of rands on petrol, driving to all sorts of interesting places, but even just in their home little area, and have submitted hundreds of cards. Even Johan van der Veste is in here, he's our top atlaser. I think he's approaching 1,100 cards at the moment. So he has spent a lot of time in the field. But he loves it. It's his passion, and he's passionate about conservation. And of course, there's all ways you can do this. I mean, you can ride a motorbike around and do it. You can hop in a boat if you need to survey birds on a dam, or just walk around in one of your favorite patches. But this is really the real hub of the Bird Atlas project is the people. The citizen scientists, because without them, we just wouldn't be in a position to do what we can with the data we have. And this is basically how it happens. So the grid cell that was used in SEBAP 1 was a quarter degree grid cell, which was a 1 in 50,000 map, okay, one of those topographical maps. if you can buy it at Surveys and Mapping. I must admit I forgot to include the larger one of this. And for Survey 2, it was decided that we are going to make the scale a bit smaller because we needed to refine it in order to collect better information. This quarter degree cell is 25 by 27 kilometers, so it's a big area. And it was quite difficult to cover, but a lot of the people in Survey 1 made real efforts to collect as much information as they could. But now we had to improve on Survey 1. So we decided that the way we're going to do this is we're going to go down to a pentad level. Okay, and a pentad is a 9 by 8 kilometer square grid cell. And there's 9 of these make up the quarter degree. Okay, so you'll have 9 of these within the larger quarter degree cell, which immediately meant that there's a lot more work to do. Okay, because we're now refining the area, but having this refinement means that we're going to collect much better quality information than we did for SAPEP 1. And you can imagine the conservation outcomes based on the smaller area compared to a much larger area. So the pentad is the scale at which one does your atlasing. And ultimately, one spends time in the pentad, a minimum of 2 hours, trying to get to all the different habitats. Because by getting to all the different habitats, we can create a longer list as we can. And that's the real aim of Survey 2, is to get a really comprehensive list of birds in this area. So ultimately, it does take a little bit of planning. You need to get the map. Well, nowadays, you can log into Google Earth and do all sorts of nice things. And have a look at the different habitats that fall within this area. And say, right, I need to go and visit Kirstenbosch and Newlands and the back of the mountain here, or the front of the mountain. There's a little bit of the harbour here where I can, you know, possibly get into. I mean, you know, there's perhaps some seabirds hanging around, and then have a look at the access. And this is what our citizen scientists have had to do. They've had to sit down and plan what they need to do in order to maximise their species lists. So ultimately, it involves planning, and second of all, realising that you need to spend at least 2 hours in the pentad recording birds, and to order your list. So in other words, you write down or record your species as you see them, in the order that you see them. Okay, that's quite important because by doing that, we're able to get an idea about how abundant species are. And the species we see first on the list, within the first hour, say, we can make the assumption that they may be the most abundant species in that area. And by doing that and translating it later on, when we do all our nice analyses, we will be able to find out exactly where that species lies on that abundant graph. So you spend a minimum of 2 hours, and sometimes one needs to go out of the pentad to get back into it, and this is why I've shown this route here on this map. This is a pilot run that we did before the Atlas actually got underway. And you just keep a record of every hour that you spend in the pentad. So you spend a minimum of 2 hours. It doesn't have to be continuous 2 hours. And the maximum amount of time that you're allowed to compile a checklist is 5 days. Okay, the first atlas was a lot more relaxed. The first atlas, you could spend a month collecting your records. And you didn't have to worry about doing it in order. You just, if you saw a bird, you just ticked it off. But ranking the abundance of species, in other words, recording them in the order that you see them, is proving to be very, very valuable. The sort of analyses that we have done so far has shown that it is proving its worth. And with a lot more checklists that are collected for each pentad, the better it is for that analysis. Roughly in a nutshell, how citizen scientists go out and collect the information. So it's about, I don't know if any of you have participated in Birding Big Day, if you're a member of the Cape Bird Club and you know about Birding Big Day, well, Sabbath 2 is a Birding Big Day in a pentad. That's really what it demands. You're trying to get to every single habitat so you can get as many different species on your list as you can. And it really, really is a lot of fun. I, in my home pentad, which is the one below this, the Plumstead Constantia Rondeflag pentad, I've been to little nooks and crannies that I never knew existed before. Okay, it makes you want to go and look for more birds. And where can I find more birds? I can find them in different places or different habitats. So it makes you want to go and visit. And it's amazing. Even now we get people, we have submitted 100 cards for their little home pentad, and they're still finding new species. You know, it's incredible. But that's what makes it exciting. In fact, what makes it more exciting is the fact that you can spend a year accessing in this pentad and next door. Well, as you begin, you'll begin to say, I wonder what happens next door year. And I wonder what happens to the south, and, you know, all depending where you are. And you go and atlas, and you find a completely different suite of species. And it's fascinating. And you say, why? You know, and why am I seeing, why are certain species more abundant? And it starts to unpack the whole essence of the atlas. It makes, it's important for citizen scientists to ask those kind of questions. Yes, we can pick it up from the data, but it's those kind of questions, I think, that keep people motivated and excited. And it gets them out into the field over and over again. And the more checklists that we can get from the same pentad, the better. Okay, so this is really how the project has progressed from day one over here. And the orange bars are the number of checklists that have been submitted, and the green bars are the number of pentads that have been covered per month. Okay, so in the beginning things were a bit slow, but you can see they picked up, and sort of after a year we started picking up the pace, and there's been a little bit of fluctuations, but basically we've been looking at getting 1,000 checklists a month from observers. And you can see that the pentad coverage per month has also remained quite stable since about a year into the project. The bars at the bottom aren't too clear, but they just represent the number of observers, the blue bars, so how many people actually take part per month and submit the data, and the yellow bars, they represent the number of brand new pentads that have been covered. So pentads covered for the very first time. And as of probably an hour ago, this is sort of the summary. So we've got 1,000 odd atlases at the moment, and they've submitted, you know, we're approaching 65,000 checklists, and amazingly, we've reached 10,000 pentads out of the 17,300 that are scattered around South Africa and Lesotho and Swaziland. So, and there were approximately 2,000 quarter degree grid cells. So you can see the amount of work that really needs to be carried out. Whether we get to 100% sort of remains a mystery, but it's going to be quite difficult to get there. And we've got all sorts of little targets that we need to meet from a statistical point of view. But it's nice that we're sort of hitting the 3.4 million record mark. So a lot of records, a lot of cards are being submitted on a regular basis, and data continuously comes in. So we're very proud to say that we've reached the sort of 58% level at the moment. And to get to the 10,000 pentad level has taken 4.5 years. So it's a lot of work, but we've eventually reached it. Okay, what I'd like to do now is just quickly run through the movie of what's happened in terms of the coverage every 6 months since the project started. Okay, so naturally we start with a blank map. and I'm quickly just going to run through, and you will see how much effort our citizen scientists have put in. So 6 months later, that was the coverage, 4.4%. Then by July the next year, 10.4% more or less. And just to mention, you can see the legend over here indicating what the color codes mean. So the yellow and orange means 1 to 3 cards, the greens sort of 4 to 10 cards, the blues 11 to 25, and the red 25 plus cards. So you can see a large amount of effort concentrated around areas where there were lots of birders, or perhaps there was a bird club in the area. And there's obviously a large concentration of effort up in Gauteng and naturally the Western Cape. So this was a year into the project, 10% coverage. 6 months later, we'd almost reached 20%. Then by the next year, 27.8%. Last year, January 2010, we were approaching 35%. July 2010, 42%. Then January last year, 48%. By the middle of last year, 53%. And then the current picture. So let's just, I think I'm going to quickly for the computer here. Okay, so here's the blank map. And you can just see how coverage has increased and the intensity of the coverage in terms of the blues and the pinks and the reds. Where a lot of the people had concentrated their atlasing efforts. So it becomes immediately noticeable that the Northern Cape represents a large gap area, as does the Ultron Sky and Lesotho. Swaziland started off quite slowly, but they've managed to increase coverage quite nicely there. Although this represents a large gap area, I think that what has been covered to date has been really, really good. It's been really inspiring to see people that have made special plans to travel out to these areas in order to collect information. And often we have planned expedition trips, and we've had two up to the Knysna region here. Before, obviously, this area was completely blank. There was no coverage. And now at least we've got a handful of cards for this region. And so there's a lot of coordination that takes place in order to get the coverage that we have at the moment. And it's all thanks to our citizen scientists for making this effort. What is also noticeable is this huge sort of square here. I don't know if you can see it, big green square with lots of the reds and pinks and blues in the middle. And this, which I will just touch on in the next few slides as well, but this was just due to specific challenges which we threw out to atlases and said we need to try and get a minimum of X amount of checklists for the four 1-degree blocks that cover Greater Gauteng, and this is what happened. So we've got this block here of green, and now we're heading for trying to get at least 7 cards for each of those pentads in that 4-degree block. So all the little things that help to motivate atlases to improve the coverage. So we need to try and get to new areas, so we need to try and go wide to get there. But we also need atlases to keep on submitting checklists for their home pentads or within a specific area. And that's all represented here by these dark pentads. So you go back and you do your same pentad every week or every month, whatever the case may be, and that's really, really valuable information. Okay, so this is what the country looks like at the moment. If we have a look at poor old Lonely Gauteng, they've only got 271 pentas, so it was no doubt they were going to get to 100% quite quickly, which they did. They're now sitting on 100% for two cards or more, and they are approaching seven cards or more, like I mentioned. They're up to 95%. So, but there's a large citizen science community up there. There's lots of bird clubs and lots of people that can become a part of the assessing community. If we look at KwaZulu-Natal and Mpumalanga, they're in the 90%, and they're really striving to get to 100% coverage. If you look at Western Cape, which I'm sure most of us represent, we're sitting at 77%, so there's still a fair amount of work to do. The Free State's in the 80%, and Northwest also struggling, but they're approaching the 60% mark. Coverage in the Northern Cape, as you can see, is only at 25%, but they've got a large number of pentas to cover. But the coverage has been very impressive, even though we have a large area to cover there. Okay, but these maps are now what has come out of the data. So we've spent 4.5 years getting our citizen scientists out there and submitting the data, and now we can start looking at comparisons between SADAP 1 and SADAP 2. And I think this is the real meat of the project at the moment, where we sit at the moment with the information that we have. So let's have a look at the ground woodpecker species that sort of inhabited rocky cliffs and mountainous areas. And this is a range change map. So what has happened between SADAP 1 and SADAP 2? So each of these is actually a quarter degree grid cell, and we've just taken all the SADAP 2 checklists and we've pull them all together so that we can compare the reporting rate from SADAP 1 to SADAP 2. But let's just run through the legend, because I think it's very important to read this so we can interpret the map. So the pink squares means that it was recorded in SADAP 1, and there aren't any SADAP 2 cards yet from those quarter degree cells. The red is SADAP 1 only, even though those areas have been covered for SADAP 2, so there's been sort of no change. And the orange, SADAP 2 is actually has a much lower reporting rate than SADAP 1. SADAP 1, the yellow squares, the reporting rates are similar. And then the greens and the blues represent where things have changed in a positive light. So we have reporting rates in SADAP 2 that are higher, and areas in the blue are where the species wasn't recorded in SADAP 1 but has now been recorded in SADAP 2. So what is immediately striking about this map is the red and the oranges, isn't it? Okay, and that sort of must start putting out alarm bells. And this is an early warning system output that we spoke about earlier. So, what is happening to the ground woodpecker? We must remember that the information that is represented here is all based on the frequency of the data that is collected, and we just have to be quite cautious sometimes in interpreting the outcomes of this map, but. With the data that we have at the moment, it really should be throwing up alarm bells and saying, what is this something happening to the ground woodpecker in South Africa? Now, this map is completely different to the ground woodpecker, isn't it? Okay. Lots of green. Okay. And what's quite noticeable here is the blue, isn't it, over here? So here we have a situation with the southern graded sparrow, where it seems to indicate that this species is doing pretty well in the most part of its range. It seems to indicate through the projects that it's becoming a lot more abundant and therefore becoming a lot more common in the areas of green. but it's also expanding its range, isn't it? We can see that it's beginning to expand its range into the southwestern Cape and into parts of the west coast up here, into the macro land. So, very interesting. Increasing abundance and also increasing its range in a southwesterly direction. Okay, here's a little bird, the orange-breasted waxbill, which we don't get down here in the Western Cape, but it's a species that likes rank vegetation next to wetlands. Okay, and it's a tiny little guy. I mean, he must be about this big. It's a really exquisite little bird. And this was actually came out when we first started looking at these range change maps. It's one of the species that we first looked at because a lot of the observers were out there and they realized, I'm not seeing these birds too often. I wonder what's going on. So we looked at the data and said, yeah, maybe there is something happening with this species. Again, there's a lot more red, there's a lot more orange around. There are patches of blue popping out here. Is there a hint that something's happening to the orange-breasted waxbill? And what that should then throw out as well is there something happening to our wetlands? Okay. We all know that wetlands are very important. They're an extremely threatened habitat. Is the decline, the so-called decline of the orange-breasted waxbill, is it somewhere linked to the fact that our wetlands are being impacted on? Okay. And then again, we have some nice conservation outputs. We have some really good policy and advocacy things to get involved with. Okay, the hummercorp. I think we're quite familiar with the hummercorp, especially when you find one of their nests, extremely large structure, which one can't really miss. But although we can't miss the nest, we might be missing the hummercorp. Okay, again, we can see sort of large amounts of orange and red. It's a mixture, but there's, you know, the spread of oranges and reds is by far more than the blues and the greens. So again, what is happening to the hummercorp? Is there something that we don't know about that comes out of this? So yes, we're collecting this data in these pentads, recording that we've seen this bird, but there might be other factors involved which we need to unpack off this and say what is happening, or are our riverine systems being degraded? Aren't there enough nesting sites for these species? Do they just have a low reproductive output? All sorts of other interesting research questions that we need to start asking as a result of this map that we've produced. Okay, what do you notice about this bird? Okay, this is a bird that we're very familiar with, aren't we? Egyptian goose. Again, it's much like the great-headed sparrow. Not much blue around, but lots of green. Okay. There are areas here, obviously, in the Northern Cape, which still need to be looked at. All these purple areas that haven't been surveyed yet. But if we just look in sort of the grassland area, the sort of high veld leading into parts of the low veld and KZN, there seems to be an increase in the numbers of Egyptian goose, making it more noticeable and therefore easy to record. And so reporting rates are a lot higher. And we all know that this bird has moved into Cape Town. It's moved into the southwestern Cape and its numbers have exploded. A lot of the times we may be aware of these things. You know, we've been living in the area for years and years and years, and we know in the back of our minds that, yes, there's been, I didn't see hardydoors 25 years ago, or I didn't see Egyptian geese 30 years ago, or whatever the case may be. But without actually documenting that, we wouldn't be able to say these things in a constructive scientific way. And through the collection of the data, in the way that we do it, we're now able to present these maps. And together with, you know, organizations like BirdLife South Africa, we can try and work towards finding ways to put this into policy or identify other work that needs to be carried out. But we all know that Egyptian geese can be a really problematic bird. The fact that its numbers are increasing is going to have all sorts of other impacts. I know golfers hate them. it's a local scale thing, but the Atlas is bringing out that the numbers have increased to such a large extent. And then I think lastly, if I remember correctly, I just want to speak about the amethyst sunbird again, because it's a bird that a slide of the SABAP 1 map I showed right in the beginning. So I just want to show you how things are changing relative to this map as well. It's sort of a mixed bag. It seems to be a lot more green around, indicating that the bird is sort of increasing in abundance. Again, there's this range distribution in the southwestern Cape, and perhaps more and more of you are finding the black sunbirds in areas where you live, where you didn't see them before, up to 5-10 years ago. So again, we are able to pick up this change. We're able to document this change because of the bird atlas. And what's interesting is the first atlas brought out that there was this gap area over here. And all of a sudden, in the last 4 years, we've been picking up little records here and there. So is the species beginning to shift its range a little bit into areas where it wasn't known before? And as we go on collecting more and more data, we'll be able to unpack this as we go along. Okay, so I think it's important for us to understand that climate change and land use change are big issues that are going to impact on our bird populations. And perhaps it is climate change. We don't know for sure right now, but perhaps it is climate change that's beginning to drive the woodpeckers up to higher altitudes. Sparrows, the graded sparrows are obviously finding that conditions are favorable in the southwestern parts of the country, and they being able to extend their range into these regions. But there are possibly other factors as well involved. And then, of course, we just speak about the Egyptian goose. And this is a bird that is able to adapt quite readily to all sorts of things. So there might be modifications in natural systems or perhaps even in the agricultural communities, farm dams, that plant trees on islands. And you do that and birds are going to move in. And, of course, they feed on the crops. So it's made of favorable habitats to these birds that weren't there before. And of course, it's a bird that has become urbanized. we see them with chicks as they walk around in the suburbs and things, and they're breeding in all sorts of areas. So we need to be aware that because our landscape is changing, it's going to have an impact on certain of our bird species. Another aspect that we can get out of the bird atlas data is departure and arrival times for migrant species. And so I quickly just want to have a look at the barn swallow, a bird that breeds in Europe and then makes its way down and spends our summer here. I'm sure we're all familiar with the barn swallow. And without going into really much detail, but we took the data from Gauteng, which, as you saw, the big green block means it had lots and lots of cards, so we could use it in this way. And basically, the birds arrive in about September, October. And what's interesting is we look at the red, the sort of darker lines here, those represent SAPAP 1. And the greens and the blues represent SAPAP 2. And what we have found with the data that has been collected and analyzing it in certain ways is that it seems as though the barn swallows are arriving just a little bit later than they were 20 years ago. Okay, is this linked to climate change or perhaps other aspects that we're not aware of? What is interesting on the other side is that when the birds depart to go back to Europe to breed, they seem to do that all at the same time. Okay, whereas they arrive in stages from Europe, but when they depart, they all seem to depart at the same time. So again, just trying to demonstrate the use of the information that we collect through the Bird Atlas project. And I can't emphasize enough, but we live in a changing world, and we've sort of devised all these little mini projects within the Bird Atlas project, and we gave them all wonderful names, and this is all thanks to Les, I'm afraid. When you work at the ADU, you live in an acronym world. So we gave them all these wonderful names, like, for example, when it was the Soccer World Cup, we had a thing called Goals, Go Accessing and Love Soccer. We had Bash, which I think was the 2009 year. The following summer, we called it Deja Vu. Which was December, January, Accessing Vacation Unlimited, but of course it had other connotations as well. But basically, we now could do this and have an opportunity to monitor changes in the birds' distribution and abundance at particular times of the year from one year to the next. And that wasn't possible with Step 1. Step 1 was just all the data was put together and eventually was analyzed and there was a map. So it was a snapshot of what was happening. Yeah, we can get the movie, as Les likes to call it, so that every year we can see what's happening and we can do a year-by-year analysis or a mini-project analysis every year and see what's happening on a more regular basis. And so that's why I highlighted the WHAM, the Welcome Home All Migrant Birds, in 2009, which was the same as Festival in 2010. So it's just small little things like this that keep our actresses motivated, and to realize and make them more aware that we're doing this for a purpose, that it's all for a scientific project. And these are the sort of coverage of some of those projects. So this is the Deja Vu project and the Festival projects, and we set targets for the number of cards, and usually those were all met. So the Atlas has really put in a lot of effort over these periods. And then just recently we've launched one for the Southwestern Cape. It's called the 3DDG Challenge, which is 3 Diagonal Degrees Green. Okay, it's not really a good acronym, but there's the 1 degree blocks over here, 1, 2, and 3, and then everything to the southwest of that. And what we're trying to do is trying to get each pentad to turn green. So we want 4 cards from each pentad. And we've got a coordinator, an atlaser, who's actually running this, and he sends out reports regularly, emails and things, so that we can get people to go deep and to go wide. So we want lots of pentads looking like this, but we also want to get these, the yellow and orange ones, to green. So if you have a holiday house down here in the Overberg somewhere, or out in the Karoo, or the West Coast, and you're a birder, then there's a chance that you can make a contribution to setup too. Okay, but really, are our citizen scientists, are they happy doing what they're doing? Are they satisfied? And Dale Wright did his MSc last year. He graduated last year, and he looked at this specific subject that we need to understand the people who make it possible. So it was looking at the people aspect of Step 2. You know, it's all very well, we all love birds and we love to go out accessing, but how does it affect you as the accessor? And this is what Dale looked at. And so he had stakeholder questionnaires and meetings with people, and he set up an online accessor questionnaire. And he wanted to basically describe the motivations and their level of satisfaction. And how does it link with how they take part? Are they ambassadors for biodiversity? Because this is really what citizen scientists are. You're out there representing the biodiversity conservation and initiatives that are taking place. Is there burnout? And are there any constraints on the actresses? So he hit all of us, and he, He developed environmental volunteer functions inventory, and this included looking at all sorts of aspects like recreation and nature-based tourism and values and the social aspects and how the project's organized. And glad to say that all came out really positive for us, that they are all highly satisfied with these aspects, okay, which is really great news, because we need to understand that citizen scientists are volunteers, and they are giving up their time and resources to make these contributions, but they are extremely satisfied in what they are doing. And I just put up just to show you that part of the survey, how did they get to know about the Atlas? And a large proportion through the word of mouth. So passing on the information, I see a birding buddy, why don't you get involved? I'm having such a great time, why don't you also make a contribution as well? And a whole range of other notification processes. But what constrains Atlases the most, or what came out of the survey, was time and work. So this meant that if people didn't have to work, they would be out atlasing, which we would love. Okay, but not everybody can make it a full-time job. But those were the two things. So again, it just showed that these people just couldn't wait to get out into the field. They were just having such a good time. I think nowadays the field costs over here might be moving up a little bit more towards the center of the scale as well. But generally, everybody said, I wish I had enough time, or I didn't have to work. so that's really positive for us, that they are highly motivated. And there's also of other outputs that the project has been able to get involved with, or how the data is used. And a lot of it is that it's accessible to the public on the website. We've now gone that route, so you can go onto the website and have a look at the data. We supply data to consultants, and BLSA, together with EWT, have developed a wind farm sensitivity map using the Bird Atlas data. And supplying data for all these avifaunal assessment works, and being used by undergraduates and postgraduates, and there's a whole host of other outputs and uses for the data. Okay, this is the hub of the project, which is our website. There's the address over there, the web address. And what's really nice is that right at the top it gives you a summary of what's happened to date. And then this year we've started off with a thing called SABAP 2012. So we've got a blank sheet, and we want to see how far we can go in this year to get the coverage that we had last year. Okay. So like I said, we can do this on an annual basis now. We can have a look and see by having a blank sheet right at the beginning the extent of the coverage per year. And so over here we've got the maps, and you just have to click on the maps here to make them larger, but that's overall, and this is what's happened so far this year, and we're on about 3% coverage at the moment. And this will just help us keep track of the of coverage as we go along in the year. There's all sorts of news, and you can download information if you want to know how to take part. There's a how to participate link. You can look at species maps and all sorts of things on here. So I would like to just encourage everybody, if you can, and if you are interested, to learn more about the project and or get involved, to visit the website and just click on the links. Not all these menu items will be available, because it's all based on a login system. Once you become an observer, you need to log in. But there will be the sort of basics on there that you need. But this is the portal where everything happens. All the news items over here, which keep Atlases up to date with what's going on. Okay, just to end off, I'd like to just briefly talk about a new project that we've got on the go, and that's called My Bird Patch. And it's linked to SABAP 2 in a way, but it's done on a much more finer scale than SABAP 2, and it has a lot more appeal to birders, I think. And this is a shot taken of part of the website. And this particular portal has been designed so that eventually one can start entering data for some of our other projects, our large terrestrial bird count project, CAR, and as Les mentioned earlier, about Quack, the water bird count project. But ultimately, the project started with my bird patch. And what is my bird patch? Well, it's fine-scale bird monitoring. The setup two scale is far too broad for us to actually look at how things are changing locally. And we know things are changing locally on a fine scale. But how can we actually monitor that? So it's going to supplement data that we get out of setup two. And we can have a look and say, well, are these changes isolated? Or perhaps are they evenly spread in a pentad? We just, for the first time, being able to implement a project where one can have a look at the fine scale changes in bird populations. It's never been done before at this level, at a national level. And we're trying to get more and more people on board so that we can have a look at these things. All sorts of other benefits. We can look at greening projects. You know, we can look at our parks and things and saying how are these being managed and areas that are being greened, how are they impacting on our local species. And the impacts of disturbance and developments, even at this scale, that can aid all sorts of things like conservation planning within your municipality, and it makes all sorts of contributions to climate change work. And ultimately, it's about bird monitoring in your comfort zone, which is quite nice. Because a patch is quite small and it can constitute any one of these, a garden, a school, a golf course, perhaps a local reserve or something, a green belt, or perhaps any open space that you have, or perhaps a neighborhood walking route. You're going to walk with your dogs or cycling route, whatever. These are the kind of areas that fall into my bird patch. So it's quite accessible and it's easy to do. And really, it's about making bird lists with an emphasis on abundance. So you could, it's a real good opportunity for us to start looking at how many birds occur of each species. Okay, because we're going to be, as you'll see just now, I'll show you the size of the patches. They're quite small. And as you make a list of birds in these patches, it allows you to try to estimate abundance. Okay, whereas the atlas, we're just looking at presence, absence. We're not actually counting the number of birds. It's not the main objective of the atlas. But here we can do that, and it's going to supplement the bird atlas data. And of course, now we've got a chance to collect breeding information as well, which can be collected as part of the atlas, but it isn't the priority. And really, it's about one-day lists. The bird atlas list is 5 days long, or the maximum amount of time is 5 days. My bird catch list is just 1 day, and it can be anything from 10 minutes to the whole day, depending on the size of your patch. And it can be done every day. If you go walking every day, or if you cycle the route every day, you can make a list every day and submit it, or once a week, or once a month, whatever suits your schedule. So it's quite flexible, and it's a lot more relaxed than the bird atlas protocol is. And the reason why we like emphasizing to visit your patch regularly is that we can get long-term monitoring data. That's important. The longer that we collect it, the better the quality of that information. And of course, a great way to make a contribution to biodiversity conservation and ultimately form a part of the early warning system that this series is all about. This is on the website. There's a link there called Sites where you can go on and you sort of select an area that you're interested in, and this is what pops up. And so the blue areas are public sites and the red areas are private sites. So you can mark your site as being private. We're trying to sort of recommend that it be public, but a lot of the sort of gardens and things are being kept private, which is fine. It just means you won't be able to see what's going on in each site. But these are the kind of areas that we enfold with. So here is UCT and the Rondebosch Common. There's a much larger patch over here. Yeah, it looks like a little small patch in garden somewhere. So you can see the size of the patch. It's very, very small. And you can have your house, your garden as your patch, and you can have a much larger patch within that patch, or a small patch within a much larger patch as well. And you'll be able to click on these links over here and actually go and view the species list for all the public sites and not the private sites. So that basically brings to end my contribution to this part of the early warning system presentations that are being done this week as part of the ADU summer school. And I think just to end off with that we've got SEDA 2, which is a very, very important project. It's a priority project for us. It's a high profile project just in terms of the national scale which has been done. But together with that, we've got the My Bird Patch project, which I've just spoken about. And that's at a local level, so a fine scale level. And even if you can't see yourself being involved with the Bird Atlas, then you have a great opportunity to be involved with a project that is quite flexible and yet can make a contribution and will supplement the information that comes out of the Bird Atlas. So I appreciate the time that you've given up here and encourage you to be a part of the accessing community. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Doug. I appreciate you wanting to end your time, and if you need to go, then just speak out. If you'd like to ask questions, then feel free to stay and ask Doug. Give him a couple of minutes to answer questions.
And you're welcome to come and speak to me afterwards as well. Right.
I think I would like to tell you that you're talking about the Egyptians to see what they're doing down their island, which is a big bay. Parents, when they hatch their babies, they have them out on the sea the day that they're hatched. Mm. And these things swim about 30, 40, 50 meters up, and you see them surfing in on the waves. And you would think that they've done this all of their lives. Absolutely amazing. It's quite frightening to see how they can increase.
No, absolutely. Oh, no, I mean, I've also witnessed them on the sea as well, and it's quite amazing. but yeah, it just becomes very noticeable, doesn't it, when you start seeing a species and say, these birds just haven't been at these levels in the past, and now all of a sudden they're becoming very, very abundant. And, so yeah, but it's important to take note of it, and that's why it's actually more important to try and document these things. So, otherwise, it's hard for us to put any sort of conservation action into it, ultimately. But, yeah.
Right, I think we should call it a day there. Thanks, Doug. I think what characterizes all these talks we have this week, I think, is passion and enthusiasm. And thanks, Doug, for your passion and your enthusiasm that you've put into this project and which has been contagious. And thank you very much. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks.